You're listening to the Rightstream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rightstream and hashtag Rightstream. Thanks for listening to the Rightstream Radio Network.
Welcome to the Speculative Fiction Cantina with your host, S. Evan Townsend.
And this is the Speculative Fiction Cantina. It is your weekly hypodermic injection of science fiction, fantasy, horror, alternate history, steampunk, cyberpunk, and all things weird and wonderful in the world of books and writers. I am your host. I am S. Evan Townsend. I write science fiction and fantasy novels that cause thrills and rapid page turning. I am not responsible for paper cuts. But if you have an ebook, that's not a problem. To learn more about me and my 10 science fiction and fantasy novels, five of each, as coincidence goes, go to my website, sevantownsend.com. That's my name all squished together, sevantownsend.com. Or you can Google me, S. Evan Townsend, and my name, or my website should be the first thing that comes up. And you can check out my novels. But the show's not about me, it's about my guests, and today on the Speculative Fiction Cantina, we're pleased to welcome writers Diana Savastano and Diana Gunn. Now, how I booked two Dianas on the same show, I don't know, but we will deal with it. Anyway, if you'd like to speak with our Dianas or ask a question or make a comment, please call 347-945-7246. That's 347-945-7246. And then you need to press the one key on your phone to be put in the queue for going on the air. If you don't press the one key on your phone, I don't get the signal you want to go on the air, and you won't get to go on the air. So 347-945-7246, and then press that one key to put in the queue for going on the air. Finally, if you'd like more information about my guest, it's on my blog at blog.s7000.com. That's blog.s7townsend.com. There's interesting links there and links to their social media and links to their books. So go check that out at blog.s7townsend.com. So Diana S., hello.
Hello. Thank you, Evan.
How are you? Yeah, it's great having you here today. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Great. Tell us a little bit about you.
Well, I began my writing career as a print journalist. Many years ago, I was a columnist, a reporter for papers in the Florida area, South Florida area. I was a stringer for the Miami Herald. I became a food editor when I lived in Florida. And then what I decided to do when I moved out of Florida was start my own publishing company in 1992. And I published two print magazines. One was called The Collector News Magazine, and the other was called Gourmet Faire. Both of them did very well in print. Gourmet Faire took off rather quickly ahead of The Collector and later became a .com. And once I was a global publication reaching across the globe, I decided not to do print any longer. I liked that whole feeling of being online with people and that type of thing, and Gourmet Faire was up in its entirety. It had all, we had advertisers and articles and everything, so that was great.
Wow.
I created a cooking show. It was called Cooking with Grandma. It was with my granddaughter. We were never picked up, but we did have a production company who worked that show. And now I'm writing full-time, and I'm also studying to become a screenwriter.
Great.
There she is in a nutshell, I guess.
you've been busy, which is a good thing. So.
Very good thing, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Diana G., hello.
Hello.
How
nice
are you
here
today? It's great having you.
I'm pretty fantastic, actually.
Great. Tell us about you a little bit.
All right. Well, by day, I'm a freelance writer and editor doing nonfiction stuff. Mostly, I write about WordPress and social media marketing. And by night, I'm an author. So basically, my entire life revolves around books and words. And I'm sort of dabbling with scripts now a little bit. But really, it's all about the books for me and and cats. The books and the cats.
And the cats. So you basically spend your day typing and then you spend your evenings typing.
Yeah. I work from home, so my breaks are to play with the aforementioned cats, and it's pretty great life, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I do freelance, too. I work from home, and I like it. I like being able to work in my pajamas.
Yep.
Diana S., tell us about The Marker.
The Marker is, it's romance, a little bit of paranormal. It's a murder mystery. There's a lot in it. I don't know if you know this, but The Marker is an actual Civil War piece that I acquired in 1992 from an antique dealer in Florida. His story was that his son took it from a Natchez, Mississippi cemetery, brought it home to Florida, and handed it to his father, and his father didn't know what to do with it. I guess fear of retribution, maybe, because it came from a federal cemetery. The marker is a Union grave marker. You can hold it in your hand. It's a Union marker from a federal cemetery, so I'm not sure what the federal laws are about taking something out. Anyway, I purchased it with the understanding in my mind that I was going to return it to the cemetery because I didn't believe anyone should have a piece like that. But when I held it in my hands, I did feel a very strong connection to it, and I heard those words in my imaginary mind there, write my story. So that's what I decided to do. And in researching the piece, I did contact the Natchez Cemetery, and they verified that the piece was authentic. It was reported missing in 1952, and that verified the antique dealer's story to me. So I told them, they asked me, what are you going to do with it? I said, I'm going to return it. And when I finish my book project, and they said that they would like to have a ceremony when I do return it. I did return it. I returned it in December 2017. But that's the basis of the book. The thing that I felt from the beginning with The Marker was that it was not a Union soldier. I kept saying, this is not a Union soldier, and everybody kept saying, well, this is a Union marker, so what could the soldier be? He's a Confederate soldier. And so that's how the story begins. It begins in the prologue in 1863 with Dr. Bradley Taylor. He's a medic and serves in the Confederacy, of course, and he's killed on the battlefield and dragged into the woods and left there, and someone changes his uniform, and when he realizes that his uniform has been changed, he reaches down for his buckle and realizes from the embossed letters that it's a U.S. buckle. He grasps it, and he slips into eternity with the buckle in his hand, and so when he's disinterred, they assume he's a Union soldier, and thusly he's buried in the Natchez Cemetery. So that's all true up to that point. The protagonist, current day, she's a journalist in Manhattan. She goes about finding the marker just as I did. The rest of the story is all fiction. And the marker actually becomes the conduit between Dr. Taylor and Jennifer Beasley, who's the protagonist, and it goes on from there.
Wow. That's cool. I like that.
Yeah, the most exciting part. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
The most exciting part of this whole thing is the return of the piece to the cemetery, because it's now in a display case for everyone to see.
Oh, okay.
Amazing. And did I mention your book? Is there a little plaque there saying that this piece is featured in this book?
Unfortunately, the Veterans Administration is a government agency, and they cannot mention the book itself. My name is there. But they cannot mention the book and could give no credit to the book in any way. because the United States government does not do that. And so that was fine with me. I didn't care about that. I cared about giving it back to its final resting place. And it's there. If anyone wants to go see it, it's in the Natchez VA National Cemetery in Natchez, Mississippi.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is a ways away for both me and Diana S., or Dan G.
Well, you never know. You might want to go to Natchez one day.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Mississippi is one of the few states I have not been in. I haven't been in the southeast of the U.S. very much. Been in all over.
It's a beautiful state. Beautiful state.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Diana G., tell us about Keeper of the Dawn.
All right. Well, Keeper of the Dawn is my first book, and it is a YA fantasy novella, which means it's a little bit shorter than a novel. It's a quick, easy read. And it is about a young woman named Lai who has spent her whole life training to become a priestess. And in every year, essentially, only one girl is able to become a priestess. And so the story begins at the beginning of the priestess trials. And the story is actually about her failing to become a priestess and having to find a new life after that and a new way to serve her goddesses.
Yeah,
and
she finds a way, I assume.
Yes, she finds a mysterious city that seems to worship the same goddesses she does and works to build a life there. I really can't sum up the story any better than the tagline of my blurb, which is brilliant. Keeper of the Dawn is a tale of new beginnings, second chances, and the endurance of hope.
Ah. That sounds great. And it's a YA fantasy, correct?
Yeah. And I think that it was really important to me to tell this particular story because so many people, so many teenagers especially, have, you know, these big dreams. And often we can get to something like that dream, but the route is very different from what we expected. You know, like I had to become a freelance writer before I could become an author.
Yeah. Okay. I did the other way around, but that's okay. Yeah. I won't tell the story of how I became a freelance writer, but it's actually kind of amusing. Diana S., you said there was a ceremony when you brought this marker back to the Natchez National Cemetery in Mississippi. What was the ceremony like, and how did it make you feel?
It was a bit emotional for me. Because I had it so many years. You know, I bought it in 1992. I finished the book in September 2017. But as a working writer, it was very difficult to find the time to complete this novel. And I think it was a timing factor. I knew that the right time was going to happen for me. And it did. So I had it for so many years. My husband and I, you know, we put it in a box, sealed it away. Very seldom took it out to show it to anyone. And it was just slightly emotional. Of course, my whole family wanted to be there. My granddaughters wanted to be there to see this because they grew up knowing about this piece and how important it was. The interesting thing about this piece, and this is in the book, certain people, when they feel it, that's part of what I'm going to read when I read you a little bit about it. Certain characters within the book, when they hold it, they feel something that changes them. It's either the physical or the mental. Well, one person I handed it to just briefly said, "Do you know what this is, or do you feel anything?" They rejected it. They pushed it away. They had no idea that it was a memorial grave marker. It doesn't look like a grave marker, as you can see from the book. It does not. It's a star-shaped cast iron piece. And that kind of, you know, motivated me then. Okay, this person had a negative feeling about this piece. And so anyway, I cannot even begin to explain how thrilled I am that it's where it is. I feel that it's come full circle. Because it was dedicated to an unknown soldier between what we know about it, it was dedicated between 1878 and 1900 when the last veteran of the Civil War passed away. They would either families wanted these pieces dedicated, or the different groups, veterans groups, would have these made and dedicated to unknown soldiers. This piece was in front of the tombstone of an unknown soldier, so it had a very, very special meaning, because Bradley Taylor is unknown for 150 years. He's buried under the tombstone that says U.S. Unknown Soldier.
Right.
So it was almost like I was bringing Bradley home.
Hmm.
But in the book, Bradley does come home in the book, but he comes to Atlanta, Georgia. So we go full circle. We go from Manhattan to Mississippi to Atlanta, Georgia. I absolutely love this story. I'm shocked that I even wrote it.
Yeah. Well, that's always nice when you are shocked at how good you write, or how well a story comes together that you wrote.
Yes. Yeah, because, you know, we're talking 150 years before the protagonist, before Jennifer Beasley finds this, and that's the longest cold case ever that I know of.
I hadn't thought of it as a cold case, but yeah, that's pretty much what it is.
Pretty much, because he's murdered, and as the story goes on, there's a connection to two other families, and it brings you to the present day families. They're all connected now in Georgia, all three families, and there's another murder done by a family. I can't give it away, but...
No, you don't want to give it away.
All right.
Diana G., you're doing a Kickstarter campaign to raise funds for editing and releasing your first full-length fantasy novel called Moonshadow's Guardian. Tell us about that.
Yes. So I was hoping to have the campaign live this week, but it is a lot of work to set up a Kickstarter campaign, so that is actually going to go live on February 20th now. I'm still putting some stuff together, but I have some incredible stuff. I'm going to be doing signed copies of both books, Keeper of the Dawn and Moonshadow's Guardian, as rewards. And I've got donated books from a variety of other indie authors, and I'm really excited to bring this book out into the world. I've actually been working on Moonshadow's Guardian on and off for about 10 years now, so it'll be really exciting to see it get out there. It is a huge, huge leap from Keeper of the Dawn. It is a much, not just more adult, but a much more serious story, and it deals with memories and trauma, and it really focuses on how do you accept if you've done bad things in the past, if you have been a bad person, how do you accept that and move forward and try to be better.
Is it a sequel, or is it related to Keeper of the Dawn at all?
Not at all. It is in a completely different world. I do have a Grandmaster universe, and at some point I'm planning to connect all of my fantasy worlds. But Moonshadow's Guardian is in a completely different world that is actually largely based off of a role-playing game my parents created for each other and allowed me to use the settings from.
Oh, interesting. That's cool. Your parents made up a role-playing game that they played for each other. I mean, that's a lot of work just to play each other.
Well, it was a heavily lightened version of D&D, so they did start with a framework they weren't building from scratch, and they mostly what they did to make it was simplify it, and it was really the settings that they built, the world that they created.
Oh, okay. All right, that's great. Diana S., you have a book called, and I hope I say this right, Winds of Pood?
Correct, yeah.
Correct. Okay, and it's a middle grade book, and there's two of them.
Middle grade book. There's book one and two. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about those.
Winds of Pood one is called Under the Puddle, and it takes it's about a brother and sister. They live in Mousel, which is spelled Mouse Hole actually. It's in Cornwall, and they live there with their parents and. Strange type of storm comes up one day, one morning. They watch this cloud come over, and a tornado comes out of it and sucks up the mother's garden, all the vegetables in her garden. And it also picks up Lewis and Lally. That's the name of the brother and sister. It picks up the their cat with a mouse dangling out of his mouth, and it dumps him into a puddle. So when the kids go out to try to find out where everything has gone, Lewis sticks his hand inside the puddle, and he's pulled in. The sister grabs his foot, and they're both all pulled in, and they all travel down to an imaginary, well, of course, it's all imaginary,
right.
But they travel down to a country called Pood. When they get there, they find that they're not the only ones there. There are three other children who have also come mysteriously through the same types of storms, one from Bali, one from Savannah, Georgia, and one from Italy. And so their quest is to get themselves home and get these three other children home, too. And that's the basis of Book 1, Under the Puddle. Book 2 is in the blizzard, and what happens in Book 1, well, I can't tell you, but what happens is they have to get back to Pooh in Book 2, and it happens in a blizzard rather than in a rainstorm type of thing.
Okay. That's
fun
that's
books.
Good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to think how to word this. When you're writing middle grade versus young adult or even adult, how do you know you're writing middle grade? What do you have to do to make it a middle grade story?
Well, it has to be for a specific age group. It's 8 to 12 or 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
For writers who don't know that or want to do a middle grade but don't know too much about it, you can Google it. What's the age level for that? And that's pretty much it. Winsor Pooh 1 and 2, that's my second and third book. My first book is On the Breath of Angels, and that's a book, a spiritual book, faith-based book. And then I have two others that are also middle grade that are out there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Diana Gunn, you've mentioned a couple times that you're a freelance writer, and is it hard for you to make a transition between freelance writing during the day and then at night writing from your imagination, or vice versa? Can you keep those two worlds separated enough that they don't intrude on each other?
I feel like it didn't used to be, but lately it has been really hard. I've been working on the sequel to Moonshadows Guardian 2, and it's so exciting, and it's been really tough to actually be like, no, I need to still make time to do the work that is actually going to put food on the table and pay for me to publish this book. But I think that's mostly just because of how excited I am about this particular story that I'm working on now.
Yeah.
Usually I don't have too much of a hard time with it. I just have to take a break and actually get away from my computer for a bit. And then when I come back to my computer, I'm usually able to jump right into it.
Okay. Yeah, usually for me, since I also do freelance writing, you know, I have all my notes and everything for my freelance writing, and I just go off of those. And then when I'm writing science fiction or fantasy, it's all coming out of my head, so I don't. All my notes are just stuff I need to know, you know, science stuff or the names of characters and things like that. And so it's a whole different writing process, and it's pretty. To me, it's fairly simple, but I can see how. In fact, I had this problem with my last novel that's now in proofreading. Because I had this huge freelance assignment, and I had the same thing. I wanted to write on the novel, but I had this huge freelance assignment to work on. It was a struggle.
Sometimes making your own hours can be a curse, though, because it's so easy to be like, oh, I'll just like write down this one idea, and then realize that you've stopped doing work entirely, and you've just been writing your book for an hour.
Exactly. Diana S., you have new releases coming up?
Yes, I do. I have a new book coming out probably next month. We've been delayed on it because of the artwork. It's a book that actually, when I was with my daughter in Italy, she was about 5 and a half, and we were in Pisa, and she looked over at the tower, and just as a 5 and a half year old would do, she said, Mommy, you'd think there's a mouse in there. And, of course, she'd known I've been a writer for, you know, since before she was born. And I said, absolutely, there's a mouse in there. And so on the way back to the States, I did the outline for the story. It's the title is The Adventures of Marcello Mousetti. It's a mouse, all mice characters in the story. He's born in the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And it's going to be a 10-book series. The first one, of course, is in Italy. And he finds a way to save the tower. Unfortunately, he will always lean because he was born in the tower. So he will always be the Leaning Mouse of Pisa. And he has a nice group of character friends. There's Tilly. She's a computer geek. And there's a spider who weaves paths for them. And it's a great story, but it will be out probably next month.
Okay, how did you decide that was going to be a 10-book series?
I guess, you know, I looked at the character and said he's not going to be able to complete all his assignments in one book. And so what it's actually going to be is that he and his friends, they're almost like ambassadors to the world. They go from country to country solving the problems of that particular country. So in Pisa, of course, we know the tower is leaning. One good earthquake, and heaven forbid that tower is going to come down. They try to, you know, structure it so that it's reinforced underneath, but the tower is a problem. Venice is a problem. Venice is sinking. So Marcello will never be without finding a country to go to help them out. The book two has already been decided. He will be in London, and he will be going to the Middle East. It's a book that I designed in a way that I want to bring together children of the world, all different ethnicities, all different cultures. There'll be little bits and pieces of every culture within the book, even down to the language. So all of the books in the series are dedicated to the children of the world. So each child who buys that book simply will put their name into the dedication page, and then we will put that into our website and build a database of children, first names only, of course, around the world. And it was easy to do that. I've been writing since I was a teenager. Stories come very easily to me. I do not have writer's block. I never did. What I do get, though, is what I called character block. And that's when the characters decide that they're going to run away with my story. They're going to ambush me and run off with my story. And it's not so much that it's a block. What it is it's a change within your story. Other writers understand this, and I would assume that both of you do too. The character takes control. And for the most part, it's a great thing. Let go and let them do it.
When your characters take over, that's when it's great. Unless they do something you really don't want them to do, like get themselves killed.
Well, you know, in the marker...
That can still be good sometimes.
Well, it depends, yeah, in your storyline. But in the marker, for me, Jennifer Beasley was headed on a track. She was on a path. And halfway through the story, you know, I had her on that path. Let me put it this way. I had her on that path, but halfway through the story... She decided she didn't like that path. She was going a different way. And that meant halfway through, I had to go back all the way to the beginning to correct what was going to change and bring that change to the end of the book. So I've learned with all of my writings and let them go. Let them run. Let them run ahead of you and you just follow. It's the best way to do it.
Yep, I agree.
Your characters know best.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. Diana G, you have a blog about creativity, books, and life. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so initially I was just writing about writing, but I got really tired of that, especially because so much of my day job is writing about WordPress and marketing and stuff.
Right.
And I also realized that there's so many blogs that talk about process, but there aren't really any blogs that talk about taking care of yourself and mental health, which is strange because us writers are collectively a pretty messed up bunch of people. So I've been shifting my focus towards mental health, and I've actually started a YouTube channel recently, which I've now connected to it. So on Mondays, what I'm doing is I'm doing a video, and then my blog post is actually a sort of transcript, so you can either read or watch the content. And I started doing that about a month and a half ago, and it's really a lot of fun.
All right. That's great. Yeah, writers are, we all have, we're eccentric is what I like to say.
I like to say we have overactive imaginations.
Well, that too.
Yeah. And that,
it's a combination of factors.
Yes. And you just have to write it. You know, you just have to get it down. That's the exciting part of writing, is having a story idea pop into your head, and all of a sudden, 3 weeks later, you have your characters outlined, you have your story outline, and halfway through it, you're thinking, okay, this could be a screenplay too, you know.
Right.
That's the exciting part of all of
that. Sounds about right.
Yeah, I tell you, for me, I wouldn't give up this career for anything. This has been a passion, and I absolutely love it. And I encourage anyone who's listening who wants to become a writer, just do it. Get your desk, get your pen, your pencil, your laptop, and start to write.
Yep.
Doesn't have to make sense in the beginning, but just start writing.
You can't
in fact,
write,
I would encourage people to not make sense in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you can't fix the first draft until you've written the first draft.
Mm-hmm.
Is what I tell people.
Exactly.
And
don't get discouraged. There's a lot of revision work. And don't edit your own manuscript.
No.
Do not do that because it won't work, but you can do the revision work, and you should do the revision work.
Yeah.
And it may take 10, 12 revision. Who knows?
I would say you can edit yourself, but you can't only edit it yourself. There's a lot of stuff you can do yourself, but you still need a second and ideally third pair of eyes. We all do.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. I edit revise my. I'm a pantser. I don't outline, so I have to go through and read the novel to make sure the guy doesn't walk in with blue pants on and walk out with red pants on. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's the importance of outlining.
Yeah, I know. My brain doesn't work that way. I don't think
mine worked that way either in the beginning, but once I started to do a script. And my instructor said, this is the way you have to do it. Then I realized, okay, this has to be done even in writing a novel. It's easier for the writer to do it that way, because then you just go back to your notes and see, oh, wow, she's not 38. She's 48. You know,
she hasn't
come from New York. She comes from California.
She has blue eyes.
Those are just
the
little things.
Yeah, but those little things are very important in your final book when you get it printed, because those are the little things that the reviewers are going to look at and say, whoa, you didn't get that right.
But like the reason that I've started outlining, because I definitely was a pantser and I definitely pantsed Keeper of the Dawn, but the thing is, Keeper of the Dawn started as a short story and then became a novella, and it took me a really long time to get through it because I had no plan, so I just kept having to go back to the drawing board and make it longer and add stuff and add more stuff and add more stuff. And Moonshadow's Guardian I've been working on for 10 years for a very similar reason. So for Moonshadow's Guardian 2, I decided to try, you know, writing like a full 5-page outline. I know that's fairly small for some writers, but for me that's a lot. Mm-hmm. But I can already tell, you know, in the first draft, it made such a huge difference.
Yeah.
And I'm going to spend way less time editing that book.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll have to try outlining. We'll be back with our guests, Diana Savastano and Diana Gunn, in a few moments.
You're listening to the Speculative Fiction Cantina on Right Stream Radio.
And now it's time for the Shot of Science, your jigger of scientific news. Today's story comes from space.com, and the link to the full story is on my blog at blog.s7townsend.com. It's at the bottom of the blog post about today's show. The search for signs of life on Mars may need a bit of a rethink, some scientists argue in a new study. A popular strategy calls for investigating spots where waterborne sediment accumulated long ago, like the ancient lake bed environment that NASA's Curiosity rover discovered inside Mars's 96-mile-wide Gale crater. Here on Earth, such ancient habitats have preserved bountiful evidence of ancient life, but that doesn't mean the same will hold on the red planet, according to the study team, which was led by Joseph Michalski, an associate professor at the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Hong Kong. Mars is not Earth, researchers wrote in a study called A Perspective Piece that was published online on December 18th in the journal Nature Geoscience. We must recognize our entire perspective on how life has evolved and how evidence of life is preserved is colored by the fact that we live on a planet where photosynthesis evolved, they said. Even if photosynthesis did evolve on Mars, questions remain as to how successful surface life would have been and whether evidence of that life could have been captured in the sedimentary record. For surface life to really get going and therefore have a good chance of being preserved in the lake bed deposits, photosynthesis would probably have had to evolve on Mars at least 1 billion years earlier than it did on Earth. Michalski and his colleagues don't think that's a good bet, so they advocate for prioritizing spots where subsurface life may be once teemed on Mars, environments such as the ancient hydrothermal system, which may have been the life's cradle here on Earth. And you wouldn't have to dig very deep to find such systems. NASA's Spirit rover stumbled on the one inside Mars' Gusev crater back in 2008 when its wonky wheel scraped away some surface dirt. Such reasoning could soon have real-world applications. In 2020, Mars plans to launch a life-hunting Mars rover that will collect and store rock samples for eventual return to Earth. But the Mars environment has been so harsh historically that these scientists think life must have evolved underground on the planet. And that is today's shot of science.
This is the Speculative Fiction Cantina on Right Stream Radio.
And we are back with our guest, Diana Savastano. I am saying that right, Diana, right?
And oh, yeah. Diana, you are.
And Diana Gunn. If you'd like to speak with either of our guests or ask a question, make a comment, please call 347-945-7246. That's 347-945-7246. And then press 1 to be put in the queue for going on the air. Again, if you don't press that 1 key on your phone, I won't know you want to go on the air, and you won't get to go on the air. I think it even says press 1 to be talk to the host. So 347-945-7246. And then press the 1 key for going on the air. Diana S., you have something to read for us today?
Yes, I do. I'll give you just a brief background. This is our protagonist, Jennifer Beasley's cousin, and his friend who believes she's a psychic. Okay, and so they want to see the marker. This is how I'll set it up. They want to see the marker. Elaine and Billy stared blankly at the object they came to see. "May I hold it?" Elaine asked softly. Jennifer handed it to her and waited for a reaction, but there was none. Elaine examined the front and the back, turning it over and over. "This is going to sound strange, even for me," she said, squinting her eyes as if trying to get a clearer picture of something or someone. "The only thing I see is a white horse. How incredibly odd is that? Oh, gosh, this is intense. The presence of this magnificent animal awakens an excitement within. Jennifer, if you ever see a white horse, speak to it." Jennifer suppressed a laugh. "A horse? I'm supposed to talk to a horse? How silly is this?" Holding the marker securely, Elaine covered it with her other hand and closed her eyes. A heavy sigh escaped her lips. "Oh my," she blurted. "I feel warmth flowing from the palm of my hand to my elbow. It's warm and soothing. That's better, much better. Pain is gone. What a relief." Jennifer turned and shot a questioning stare at Billy. "She has a severe case of tennis elbow," he whispered. "Doctors tried everything, told her surgery was the only answer." Elaine opened her eyes. "It has powers," she said with authority. "I will be bold and say that it has curative power. Right now I am free of pain in my arm. It's just that simple." She handed the marker to Billy. "What do you feel?" she asked, beaming. "It's cold," he said slowly, scrunching his face and squeezing his hands as if trying to will the marker to do something. "There's no warmth, only cold metal against my hand." "Close your eyes," demanded Elaine. "Stop trying to control its power." Billy began to fidget, afraid of what might happen next. He tried to give it back to her. She refused it. "Relax," she said. "Let it guide you." He listened, and a sensation of warmth slowly flowed through his hands. A startled look crossed his face. "Don't let go," Elaine said. "I feel weird. I can see inside my body. This is scary." "No," screeched Elaine. "Don't allow fear to take over. Where are you?" "I'm moving through a sea of red." Elaine got the chills. "Go inward. Don't stop." Billy took a deep breath. "I can feel warmth in my chest. Why is that?" "Because it's where your heart is. Because it's where your condition must be." She turned to Jennifer. "What's wrong with him? Tell me the truth." Billy nodded, giving Jennifer permission. "Billy has had rheumatic fever when he was a child. His heart valves are dangerous." "Where are you, Billy?" Elaine asked harshly. The intensity of her voice frightened Jennifer. "I don't know," Billy answered. "It's dark, and there's a steady, soft thumping in my ears. Gosh, for the first time in my life, I feel quiet settling inside my body." Jennifer began to cry. Elaine bowed her head, traced the sign of the cross from her forehead to her chest and shoulders, and murmured a Polish prayer. The end. Unless you want to hear more.
No, yeah, I was ready to hear more. That's very interesting. Yeah, that's great. Very, very good descriptions and the interaction between the characters. Yeah, I can see how your characters can take over.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Diana G., do you have something to read for us today?
I do. I will also need to give a little bit of background. So this is a scene just before the priestess trials begin. For the trials, all of the initiates have to go through a couple days of cleansing in an ancient temple. And this scene is a dream that Lai has during her time in this temple. And the other thing you need to know is that Taelana is the goddess of fire and is the goddess out of all of the goddesses and gods in her pantheon that Lai is most drawn to.
Okay.
Lai found herself standing at the edge of a clearing lit by a full moon hanging low in the sky. Up ahead, a lake glimmered in the moonlight. Six people stood around it, their backs to her. Forest grew thick on either side, ancient trees stretching towards the sky. She took a step forward, careful not to make a sound. All the same, the people beside the lake turned to face her. The moon glowed brighter, illuminating their faces. Lai stared at them, recognition quickly turning to shock. They were not people. They were her gods. She saw it in their familiar faces. She felt it in her bones. She had known them her whole life. Taelana, dressed in burgundy riding clothes, came forward. "Do not fear. You would not be here if you weren't welcome." Lai knelt anyway. Priestesses often communicated with the gods in their dreams. It made sense for an initiate to do so the night before the trials. And if they were real, this was probably another test. A test I can't afford to fail. "We did not bring you here to worship," Taelana said. "Rise." She got up, still watching the ground. "Face me properly," Taelana demanded. Lai raised her gaze slowly. The goddess had already crossed the clearing and stood within arm's reach. She carried a crimson pillow which held two slightly curved blades the width of swords and the length of Lai's forearm. Nero, a style of blade invented by her earliest ancestors. The wooden handles were painted bright red. "What are these for?" Lai asked. "You." Taelana held the pillow out towards her. Lai stared at the blades. "A gift from the goddess herself?" The handles fit her hands perfectly and the blades weighed almost nothing. She had spent years training with the Nero and tried many different pairs, but none as fine as these. Taelana smiled and took a step back. The pillow vanished and another set of Nero appeared in the goddess's hands. "Shall we test your new blades?" Taelana asked. Lai gulped. The goddess surely didn't want to fight her. You are here to prove your skills, Taelana said. Of course, I can always send you back. Lai had no idea what fighting her favorite goddess would win her, but leaving meant failure. So she tightened her grip on her knives and moved into a defensive stance. I'll stay, she said. Good, Taelana said, lowering herself into a defensive position. Let us begin. Lai nodded, letting instinct take over as she raised the knives to cover her face. The world around them blurred, but she saw every detail of Tiana's stance, how far apart her feet sat, the angle of her sword, the neutral expression on her face. Her beautiful face, with its reddish-brown eyes and long, pointed chin. Focus. They circled each other three times, each time closing some of the distance. Lai could not bring herself to strike first. She barely even believed this was happening. Halfway through their fourth circle, Tailana came in, swiping toward Lai's head with one knife. Lai ducked and rolled sideways. She raised her arms and caught the next blow with her left blade. She pushed with all her strength, driving the goddess back. After a moment, Tailana jumped away, putting some distance between them. Lai stood no chance of winning, but she held her own for what seemed like hours, fending off one blow after another until her muscles screamed. Finally, she decided to throw all her strength into one move. The fight had to end sometime. Surely, the goddess didn't want her to simply give up. Tightening her grip on the Nero, Lai dove towards Taylana's feet and hit the ground hard. She rolled between the goddess's legs and thrusted her blades out, digging them into Taylana's ankles. The goddess remained standing. Lai held her breath. She wouldn't be able to get up again before Taylana could kill her, if that was what the goddess had in mind. Taylana moved away, a broad smile on her face. "You pass," she said. "Does that mean I'll become priestess?" But Taylana had already turned away. She faced the sun as it appeared over the tree line, raising her arms to the sky. Lai shielded her eyes as the goddess burst into flames. Lai screamed, but Taylana didn't, her face spreading into a blissful smile as her human form burned away, her arms becoming fiery wings, her legs transforming into a massive tail. Finally, her head transformed into a phoenix's head, her mouth stretching into a beak and her hair turning into fire. With a great cry unlike anything Lai had ever heard before, the goddess took off toward the sun. Lai squinted into the sun for a long time, as if Taylana might fly back out of it at any moment. That's it. Done.
All right. Great. Thank you for sharing that. All right. Yeah. But what I found interesting was the god, you know, goddess fought her and then wouldn't tell her if she won or not. I guess she's going to have to find that out later.
Yep.
Yep. Diana S., I mean, you write for pretty much for a living. When did you start writing and why did you start writing?
I started writing when I was a teen, and I don't have an answer to the why. It just was always there. I just always felt that I was going to be a writer. I'd like to say I was born with a pencil in my hand, but that's, you know, so many writers say that. And so much of that is true. But that's when I started. And I started really with a family newspaper where I cut and paste the articles in and sent it out to the family, and once I saw how much they liked it, it was like, whoa, I could do this. And, you know, 30 years later, I started my own publishing company saying, I can do this. Yeah. But along the way, you know, working for magazines in the 80s and 90s, we had to do our own layout. We had to get our own photography. And when I worked for Food Magazine, that was great because I was in and out of restaurants with chefs and on the business side magazines, other magazines, that was a little more on the boring side for me. But you learned to do everything when you worked for a publication, and that was the good part. You got on-the-job training for every single thing. So when I started my own magazines, I pretty much knew how to lay out the magazine and, you know, get the advertising. I wore a lot of different hats, and you know, it developed. Everything developed from the time I was a teenager when I first did that first family newspaper.
Wow.
It's amazing to me to see all of that come to this. That's why I tell everyone who has a desire to write, make sure it's your passion.
Yeah.
Make sure you have a passion for it because it will stick with you all through your life. And it will be the greatest thing that you could ever do is to get your words down on paper and have people read those words and say, gosh, I really felt that. I really like this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Diana G., I'm going to ask you the same question. Why did you start writing and when?
Well, when I decided to be a writer, when I was a kid, I sort of had this impression that all writers were dead. And I think that's just because of the books that we had lying around the house.
And white.
But I'm kind of a youngin', so I was introduced to the concept of living writers through a series called Harry Potter. And I think it was around the third book when she really started to take off. And my mom said something to me about it, and it just sort of clicked. It was like, wait, I can write books for a living? That's crazy. I want to do that. And I don't remember actually starting writing then, but it just, it kept burning within me. And I did my first NaNoWriMo when I was 11, and I haven't looked back.
Cool. I did my first NaNoWriMo when I was 50-something. I hadn't heard of it before that. Diana asks, here's a question I ask everybody who's on the show. Why should anybody buy your books?
Because they would be interested in the subject matter. Somebody interested in a murder mystery that has a little bit of romance, that has a little bit of the supernatural, would buy The Marker. Somebody who loves to go into an adventure with their children to another land, another culture, they would buy Winds of Pooh. Somebody who has one of the books that's of Kindle is The Upside Down Inside Out Life of Maureen Kiernan. Maureen plays the cello. She's 13 years old. She loves New York. She's going to Juilliard. That's her dream. All of a sudden, the rug is pulled out from under her, and she's moved to Peach Hill, Georgia, where she believes that peaches grow on a hill. She fights it. Her life changes. So someone who has a 13-year-old who might be struggling with a move or struggling with a change in a family, that would be a book that they would gravitate. The Princess Who Loved to Swim is a book about a princess who absolutely loves to swim, and she gets in trouble because of that, as she's disobedient to her father, the king. So people gravitate toward books that they're interested in. If you're interested in a faith-based book, you'd gravitate towards On the Breath of Angels.
All right. Diana G., I'm going to ask you the same question. Why should anyone buy your books?
Well, Keeper of the Dawn is a lighthearted story, and I think that's something we could all use right about now with the state of the world. And it also features a happy ending for a couple that are two women, which is kind of a problem. We have too many tragic queers, and I'm trying to do something about it. And my other books, Moonshadows, Guardian, I think people will really be drawn to it because I like to challenge the common fantasy tropes that have been used in mainstream publishing forever, and to start with those tropes and then twist them into something new and different.
Okay, that's cool. Great. Diana asks, what motivates and inspires you?
Oh, lots of things. Are you talking about in my writing?
Sure. In your life,
yeah.
In your writing?
Well, in my life, I'm motivated and inspired by the Word of God. I'm a woman of faith. For my professional side, I'm inspired by nature. I write a lot. There are cats in my books and mice and children, what they say. My granddaughter is a second grade teacher, so I hear a lot of different things that kids say in the class that are funny. It sticks with me. It can become a story. There are things all around the periphery of my life that will inspire me. Sometimes, you know, when I was a columnist, I would get cut out things that people found and said, don't you think this would make a great story? I still have them. You know, 30 years later, I still have them. Some of them have been turned into stories. Just giving me a title. My husband used to give me titles, only titles, for children's books. And from those titles, I went on to write stories, just from the title.
Wow, great. Diana G., what motivates and inspires you?
I can't imagine doing anything else. My stories burn in my soul. I dream them sometimes. I've literally had a dream and woken up and wrote an entire outline for a novel. It's just so strong in me. The stories are part of who I am. They always have been, because I grew up with parents who read a lot and who role played, where I could hear them and I could, you know, absorb those fantasy stories. And so a lot of it just comes from everything I've absorbed being put through the filter of my brain and going through my subconscious and coming back out as something completely different.
Okay, great. Diana S., we're almost at the end of the show. Is there anything I forgot to ask you about? Anything you want to make sure we say before the end of the show?
No, I think you pretty much covered everything. I just, you know, would like to say to your listeners, if they're thinking of writing a book, do it. Just do it.
Yeah.
And if you think it's a good book and you want to share it, you know, you can go to my website. I have, I also review books. If you want, if someone wants their book to be reviewed, just go to my website, send us a, drop us a note. We, my people I have who are proofreaders and editors who work with me, and PR people and publicists, we're here to help people. We don't put a price tag on what we do, unless, you know, we go into contract with someone, but we don't put a price tag on helping other authors.
All right. That's great. Diana, G, anything you want to make sure we get out before the end of the show?
Something I think I would like to add to that is really build a community of creative people around you, even if it has to be online because you live in a small town.
Yep.
Because the creative people in my life, they keep me going, they cheer for me the loudest, and I could not do anything without them. And, you know, most of them are writers, but I'm equally inspired by painters and theater performers, and it's so amazing to just absorb different kinds of art and to see people you know making them.
Yeah, I agree with that one too. Yeah, you gotta. I live in a smallish town, about 22,000 people, and I have a small writers group, and I have friends online, and you know, they inspire me. They motivate and inspire me. I'd like to thank. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I just said yeah. It's amazing to have a group like that.
Yeah. I'd like to thank my guests, Diana Savastano and Diana Gunn. Again, there's more information on these Dianas on my blog at blog.s7townsend.com. There's links to their books, links to their website, links to their social media. So go check that out at blog.s7townsend.com. And next week, tune in at the same time when our scheduled guests are Pamela K. Kinney and Judith D. Howe. I'm looking forward to that. Thank you, Diana Gunn. It was great having you on the show.
Thank you for hosting me. It was great to be here.
Great. Thank you. And thank you, Diana Savastano. It was great having you on the show.
Thank you, Evan. It was my pleasure.
Yeah. And thanks to all our listeners, and everybody have a great weekend. Goodbye.
This has been the Speculative Fiction Cantina on Right Stream Radio.